Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. It's Wednesday night, 8:30 p.m., and I'm Don Allen in Studio A. And in Studio B, we have the Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you doing, sir?
Real good, Don. Beautiful day here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Looking forward to a engaging hour-and-a-half program. Is that correct? Hour and a half tonight?
Yes, we are on for 90 minutes tonight, an hour and a half.
A lot of things going on in the world, but Don, you've been calling attention to a real serious problem that we have here in the state of Minnesota with regards to the application of Obamacare. And we have I guess you would call it a health care, quote-unquote, provider, big money poured into it. And their initial granting, they forgot to include, I guess, black folk here in the state of Minnesota don't have health problems. Why don't you walk it through us a little bit, Don? Because one of your favorite persons, Stair Step Foundation. I guess it's now the Stair Step Health Foundation. Are they a health facility or what?
I have no idea, Mr. Edwards. And I know that you remember back in 2008, Stair Step Foundation's executive director, Alfred Babington Johnson, wrote a scathing article about me that appeared in the Insight News that said that my idols were Michelle Bachman and Rush Limbaugh and Sarah Palin, et cetera. He just went into detail, and I actually answered him in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, and he hasn't said anything since. But it looks like Mr. Babington Johnson has crawled from under a rock. So let me tell you what happened here. MSHR is the state's conduit for Obamacare. MSHR's board of directors, mostly Caucasians, women, and they did a $4 million grant session. And that's not including the money that went to their advertising campaign, where they did not do any minority media either.
This was the Paul Bunyan and the Blue Ox Babe and all that? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the Paul Bunyan through the forest, which it wasn't even targeted diversely. And so They have the $4 million in grants and don't know how many million in advertising go out to, because, TV time is expensive between 6 and 10 p.m. And, they have a lot of ads running morning, midday, morning, and evening, and some in the late night. But it's prime time they're running these ads. So, they're paying on average for $400 or $500. So, with that said, they totally ignored the African-American community, Somali community, and some Hispanic community. So, people kind of complained about that. But at the top of the list of the people that were complaining was Alfred Babington Johnson of the Stair Step Foundation. And we talked about this, Mr. Edwards, a few weeks ago about the state of Minnesota and diabetes grant money that went out to the Stair Step Foundation. And, we have no reports, and it's unfortunate that these organizations wait till the end of the grant, once it's over, to get a report from these agencies. So you could basically say, well, hey, I had 985 people show up every day, and I gave them information on diabetes, blah, blah, blah. And there's no accountability. And that goes also for the Minneapolis Urban League. Yes, the Minneapolis Urban League did not get any of the MSHR grant either, but Minneapolis Urban League dismantled their health initiative on the second floor there, probably in the later part of 2010. So, why would you even give them some money? Basically to keep on the light. So, if in 2008 or 2009, Mr. Edwards, I don't remember, but the United Way, pulled $500,000 from the Urban League because they weren't serving the people that they said they were serving. And then they went back in and pulled another $500,000. So, and that was their biggest funder at the time. So,
and this came at the same time that the United Way was defunding and closing down the St. Paul Urban League, right? Is that about the same corresponding time, 2008?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely right.
Now, the Stair Step Foundation, and there was an article in a number of news articles on the news here in Minnesota this afternoon. Now, it was Senator Jeff Hayden, Democrat of Minneapolis, state senator and minority, assistant majority whip, who really got into kind of the hindquarters of the executive staff. Give us a breakdown. I mean, what is this organization now that's been formed and will be kind of the administrator of the money? What kind of salaries are these people making? And I see this afternoon they rushed to some of the board members, Caucasian board members, were saying they felt pressured to give the Negroes some money. But they gave them, what, $700,000 a day or something like that, or set a pot out, or what's the background?
Well, here's the background. Let's break this down. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 board of directors, 8 board of directors, from Brian Bertner, chair. He's an independent business advisor. Peter Benner, a vice chair, independent consultant. African-American man by the name of Thompson Alaromcomo, who we've never heard of, founder and CEO of Retrace Health. Catherine DeVoe, a doctor. Tom Forsythe, president of Global Communications at General Mills. Lucinda Jensen, commissioner of Minnesota Department of Health and Human Services. And Phil Norgaard, director of Human Services of the Fond du Lac Band of Chippewa, in Lake Superior, Chippewa. So you have this group of board of directors that are absent from anything in the diverse community.
Let me ask a question, Don, just for it. We probably need to pull that number out for our national audience in case somebody wants to call. Now, these people are appointed by who, the legislature and the governor or the legislature by themselves, or who appoints this crew?
Well, if right here, they're having an application session. Well, it was closed out Friday, September 6th, for the board advisory committees. And I think each of these people are, the board of directors are, I mean, just according to state law, board membership must be include representation from outside the 7-county metro area, with one of the 6 members having experience representing the needs of the vulnerable populations and persons with disabilities. The remaining members must represent interests of Minnesotans in the following way. It gives some bullet points. But it's the appointed by the governor through the state's open appointment process and confirmed by the state, Minnesota Senate, and House of Representatives. The Commissioner of Human Rights is a standing member. Board members serve.
Who?
The Commissioner of Human, of Human Services is a standing member.
Yeah, that's what I thought, Don. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, board members serve staggering 4-year terms and are limited to 2 terms of service. All appointed members must have demonstrated that they do not have a conflict of interest.
Okay.
But Mr. Edwards, these people, the state legislature and the Senate and the House, I guess, they knew who they were appointing to these positions. And I don't know why come in through the back door now and say that, oh, you guys blew it. You absolutely blew it. Plain and simple,
okay.
Quote from Senator Hayden. But yeah,
now let me ask a question, Don. Is this the same group that gave a convicted felon in Wisconsin who pointed a shotgun at a Wisconsin deputy sheriff, and they gave him a nice chunk of money here, and there was a little controversy about a week and a half ago? Is this the same group, same entity, same organization?
Well, I am not familiar with that. But if it's Insure, and if this person was associated with Insure, it is the same group. But Mr. Edwards, here goes another problem. I'm counting here. I'm looking in the studio just looking at their staff. I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. There's not one person of color on their staff, the Insure staff, led by April
Todd.
Well,
maybe that's just their top administrative staff, because they're getting a lot of money, and they're going to be handling a lot of money as a part of this Obamacare piece. Maybe that's just their executive administrative staff. Is there some documentation there on your computer site there that indicates what their total complement is?
Well, I'm looking at it right here. I just clicked on staff. It's showing me the executive director, the board and federal relations manager, the policy and plan director, information IT director, chief financial administrator, operating officer, shop director, communications and marketing, general counselor, navigator, and broker manager.
Oh, they got a navigator? Is that right?
Yes, they do.
We did here in the Twin Cities behind the tornado money, which no one ever got. But go ahead. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, David.
What does the navigator do, by the way? I have to ask that question.
I, you know what?
We're very innovative here in Minnesota. A navigator does what? Navigate you through troubled waters or what?
Yeah, yeah. A navigator is supposed to bring you from point A to point B or refer you to someone at point Z. So,
okay.
I mean, it's hard. It's hard because each, like during the tornado, they had a bunch of these people that called themselves navigators. And there was only a certain percentage. The navigators at Shiloh International Ministries did not function. The navigators that worked with Summit Academy, OIC, in Higher Minnesota did not function. And so we had a problem there, you know, with these after tornado, post tornado navigators, and I mean it was very interesting. You had
okay. Well, let me get here on this and push it kind of along. Now, how did they navigate themselves away from until late this afternoon? Not giving a single contract or a single penny to a African American entity or nonprofit here in the state of Minnesota. Is there anything that anybody's put up? I mean, that was fascinating because 17.9% of people in the state of Minnesota who don't have insurance, because that's what this is all about, are African Americans. So had they made a determination that 17.9% were just not going to be provided with any kind of opportunity to acquire, health insurance? Is that what we should assume?
I would believe that's what we should assume, Mr. Edwards, because, you know, just for the simple fact that these people have millions of dollars thrown at them, and Governor Dayton and the House and the state state reps and the senators up there went ahead and decided that, you know, we're going to put these people together. They put the board together. They have, you know, I don't see no representation as far as representation in the African American community. I mean, I'm looking at the board of directors, and I never heard of any of them except for the commissioner of Minnesota Department of Health or Human Services,
okay.
I should say.
Okay.
And so, how does this happen? How did they just, you know, dismiss the African American community, the Somali community, the Hispanic Latino community? And not even use their outlets for news and information or advertising.
Well, okay, but what I want to concentrate on, Don, from this studio is the mm-hmm. African American. I mean, the Somalis got a little piece of action. The Hispanics got a little piece, I understand. The mm-hmm. blacks didn't get a dime until late this afternoon after Senator Jeff Hayden, who is the one of only two African Americans in the Minnesota Senate, and one of only three in the entire legislature. But made some pretty cutting remarks last night in a committee meeting in which he called to task the executive officers and et cetera. And all day today, we've been watching it from our catbird seat. They've been scrambling over at the state capitol to try to come up with a couple ducats, a couple dollars, a couple gold coins or whatever for the coloreds, for the blacks, if you will, to keep our mouths down. Now, in the meanwhile, the traditional group has positioned themselves they're holding the traditional hustler plate, and that's, of course, and that's the reason I keep asking the question, Don, trying to draw it out of you. I mean, StairStep is what kind of both insurance and health insurance portfolio do they have?
I've never seen one, Mr. Edwards. I've never seen one.
Oh, my.
And we know that StairStep Foundation had a Dairy Queen, frozen
tire
food
shop,
pack,
Tires Plus.
Tire Shop Tires Plus, a Burger King, Fiesta, uh-huh. the packing company, in excess of $35 million in coalition with U.S. Bank, that we have no record of what happened. And when I say we, I mean the general public, because this is nonprofit, public nonprofit, and the goal was to get jobs for people in North Minneapolis. I don't want to get too far off the subject, but StairStep Foundation, everything that they've touched has turned to crap, basically. So,
well, now, was this the same organization that was dealing with placement for convicted felons coming out of institutions, out of the penitentiaries, et cetera, about 4 or 5 years ago? Then they pick up $200,000 or $300,000 and there was never any report. Is this the same organization?
Yeah, I'm looking at their site right now, Mr. Edwards, the StairStep Foundation, just to kind of see if they still had some information. I was on here a couple of weeks ago, and They had programs. Let's go to programs.
Okay.
His Works, he's got His Works United Council, talking about connecting people to the people are struggling, connecting to resources for assistance for when the drama occurs. African American churches have served the critical needs of our people. And,
oh, that's right, because Mr. Alfred Babington Johnson is also, is he an ordained minister, or does he have a church too, or what?
You know what? I think he goes to Grace Temple in Minneapolis, and I know he has preached before, I want this guy to call in, Mr. Edwards, because there's a gentleman who keeps texting me, and he doesn't want me to tell anybody his name, but I got to just cut in and tell you this story. This gentleman that has been texting me here while we've been on the show, he just texted me this, and I find it interesting. This gentleman goes to this church where
Grace Temple,
uh-huh. And they were at a business meeting, and I'm just reading it and kind of paraphrasing here. Mm-hmm. They were at a business meeting and with some white men, and they said a prayer over the meal, and he said Babington start talking in tongues like he had the Holy Ghost. He said he scared these men, and so whatever he put on the table that he wanted, he was going to get that day. And he hashtagged it hypocrisy. So the programs I'm looking here, they have His Works United in collaboration with the Minnesota State Baptist Convention and the Minnesota jurisdiction of the Church of God in Christ and the Seventh Episcopal District of the Pentecostal Assemblies of the World and the Family Healing Restoration Network. That's the first time I heard of them. Their second program is Musical Beginning. They benefit having trained, certified birth labor helpers, as well as doulas, is documented. The indecency of infant mortality rate is reduced. Second pregnancies are less likely. It gives some information about having babies, you know, this musical beginning thing. Our doulas will be able to provide customized music patterns for mothers and child to facilitate the labor and delivery process. So basically what they're doing there is a hustle to get new mothers.
Okay, let me ask a question on this, because I think certainly our communities need to know, and other folks around the country need to know how we, quote-unquote, kind of do things up here, particularly when the African-American community is cut out and only as an emergency effort because of the embarrassment, maybe a couple dollars will be shifted. But now, where are the corporate headquarters of StairStep, and what is their staff complement? And what professionals do they have involved? Because I asked a question on the program here. What experience do they have in health insurance and such things as that?
Well, here we have President, CEO, Alfred Babington Johnson, Program Director, Ora Hoeks, Program Director,
ooh,
Marie Graham, Ora Hoeks, Program Director. That's what it says right there. Marie Graham, Program Director, Willette Whited, Program Director, Brenda Carpenter, Systems Navigator, Arnetta Phillips, System Navigator, Sean Hobson.
Wait a minute. Arnetta Phillips works for Shiloh.
Arnetta Phillips, yep, is a System Navigator. I'm looking at the staff of StairStep Foundation right here in the studio. Shonda Hobson, System Navigator, and Hortense Jones, System Navigator, is the staff. And
that's
I can go
the
to the
staff of the
StairStep Foundation.
StairStep Foundation, who will be helping Black Minnesotans qualify for health care and health insurance under the Obama plan. Am I correct in saying it like that? I'm looking here at computer, but am I correct? Is my structured definition, is that correct?
That is correct. That's what they have there for staff. And they actually also, Mr. Edwards, have a listing of their board.
And their board is?
Alfred Babington Johnson, President. CEO of StairStep.
Well, I mean, he's the CEO and executive director, and he's also chairman of the board.
That's what it looks like here. I don't see anybody else that is the president of the board here. And John Taborn,
Dr. John Taborn,
Dr. John Taborn.
Why do people leave off their professional credentials in a situation like that? Dr.
Mm-hmm.
John Taborn, who is a psychiatrist.
Yeah, and Dr. Mahmoud El Kate is the secretary.
Dr. El Kate.
Yeah, he's a secretary.
Is that right?
And Keith Elzia, ELZIA, is the treasurer, president, and CEO of the NS Group. Glenn Beckham, managing director of Harvard Enterprises, LLC, is on the board. Catherine Coleman works for 3M. David Johnson, DEJ, Art of Hair, is on the board. Ezell Jones, president of Fifth Quarter. Reverend Jerry McAfee, president, Minnesota State Baptist Convention. And last but not
he's
least.
He's no longer president there. There is a new president. The Reverend Billy Russell is now the president of State Baptist. But go ahead. Fascinating.
Linda Sloan, who is there, who is an employee of St. Thomas. And so, I mean, I am looking at that. And there is nothing here, Mr. Edwards, that would lead me to say that we could have faith that African Americans would be signed up for the Obamacare or that they even have the staff to handle that. I mean, they would have to hire a hell of a lot more people than they have now.
Well, but maybe what the intention is to route the policy underwriting to Mr. Ezell Jones and his. Does he still have his company, Premier Insurance?
I know for on here it says Fifth Quarter. It says Fifth Quarter. Mr. Edwards, we have a caller.
Oh, let's get the caller.
You're live on the air. Go ahead, caller. Who's
Mr. Allen, how you guys doing tonight?
I'm
real good. What can we do for you? What's your question?
You know, of course, it shouldn't be come to any surprise that black folks were left out of the Minshew project. Number one, when you don't have representation on the board or deciding which way monies will be dispensed, of course, you will be left out. Minorities will be left out. Now, I have to give them a little credit. I do appreciate the somewhat promptness in trying to get black folks back involved, but it is still astounding, nevertheless, that you could leave out a certain population of people when you know that in the state these are the less insured of all the cultures that exist here in Minnesota. It is amazing.
Well, it's even more amazing to me, caller, because Mr. Allen has read the names of both the staff, who I assume are qualified to meet the requirements of implementation under the Obama Act, that's to get people insured. And then the board has a number of people that I'm quite sure will be involved in aspects of the underwriting. That's the reason I just asked the question, which we'll go back to if we get additional questions from you, because Mr. Jones has a number of insurance subsidiaries, including Premier Insurance, which was very much involved in allegedly underwriting the bonding, quote-unquote, for the county jail a decade ago, which really never happened. And so I'm just trying to see, I have a better feel that given the power brokers that were identified by my associate just now as the board of directors, I just don't know how they, excuse the expression, I don't know how they got whitewashed out of the equation. And clearly, if it had not been for the very tenacious questioning last night and in a committee meeting of the Minnesota Senate by Senator Jeff Hayden, and the political pressure that was put down by the governor's staff, because this was extremely embarrassing to a liberal governor, Governor Mark Dayton, I can understand the quick fix, if you will. But my question is, 17.9% of the population of uninsured in the state of Minnesota are African Americans, and I'm just wondering, does this entity, whatever its corporate identification tag is, are they going to be able to do what the legislation requires, what the Obama Act requires? And I guess that's my question, gentlemen, you know. And what's your thinking, caller, on that?
Well, you did name a number of qualified people, but just because you got a brain don't make you smart. You know, I don't know how you leave out black folks. I don't know how that certain – and you hit the nail on the head. I think it was totally embarrassing to the administration the Dayton administration, and that's why they had to act so swiftly. But when you still look at the, what was it, $700,000 or something to that effect, or some small astronomical amount of money that...
$700,000 allegedly, according to all the major stations here. Yeah, $700,000
still a drop
awarded.
In the bucket.
Absolutely.
Still a drop in the bucket. Still a drop in the bucket. Well, that won't cover from Broadway to Penn, okay? You have to give them a little credit for trying to act swiftly, but it still is embarrassing nevertheless. And it could have been avoided, because when you get this huge grant from the government, from that federal agency, you should know already you want to look at your minority population first to make sure that they are insured, because they are the most uninsured. It is disgraceful, and somebody's head should roll. And not only should there be black representation on the staff members, the boards, there should also be Asian American, Native Americans. Any minority population should be represented on that board so that they can get a little piece of the pie, because this is a huge undertaking, but if it isn't done right, it's going to be a big screw-up.
Well, let me just say, for the purpose of transparency, it appears that there's one Native American on the board of the state agency. Mr. Allen identified an individual who identified himself as a member of the Lake Superior Chippewa. And I think that person can meet the qualification and has his tribal enrollment number and the quantum, quote-unquote, of Native American blood, if you will. So I assume there's one Native American on the board. And Mr. Allen also said there is an African American on the board of the organization. Is that correct, Mr. Allen?
Yes, there is one African American there. Let me just get back there, because I was looking at trying to find some more details about these folks. And his name is Thompson Arderincobo. He's a founder CEO of.
What are his credentials?
He has more than 14 years of experience helping healthcare organizations use their data effectively. Currently, he's the founder.
Let me cut it off right there. Then that's what I was looking for. That fascinates me, that a man who is a bean cruncher, who deals with statistical data and et cetera, did not catch the fact that there was no percentage of African Americans qualified under the Obama Act or organizations allegedly serving that contingent that were going to be funded. That is really disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
That is really disturbing. That individual that you just named, that gentleman you just named, for a living, he crunches statistics and numbers. And at some point, the spreadsheet should have said, under African Americans being awarded contracts and opportunities, 0.00. Anything else? Any other questions for us?
It is amazing. It simply is inexcusable. Gentlemen, can we for one second here talk about the ongoing situation in Syria, if you don't mind, for one second here, if I might, for a second here, if you don't mind?
Sure, go ahead. You had some observations last week. Go ahead.
I think now the president is in a situation where he's damned if he do and damned if he doesn't. I totally agree the fact that he put his foot in his mouth with the red line situation. But at some point, you have to assess this dictator using chemical weapons to bomb his own people, which may reach your allies and then maybe the United States. We don't know. And then with whom Assad has aligned himself with, you have to certainly sleep with one eye open, knowing that he can have access to nukes. I'm extremely happy that the president is using some diplomacy, asking Congress to wait on a vote and sending Senator Kerry over there to speak to his Russian counterpart. But can we trust him? I think the president said it was a quintessential point that he made. He says when he asked Congress to wait for authorizing a declaration of war, but to be prepared for anything, because this is a gentleman, these are people, individuals, that we may not can trust. So are we wrong to stay prepared and ready to go into war if Secretary Kerry, isn't able to come up with some type of good plan that Assad is able to agree to, and that we are able to trust the Russians, when are we wrong for staying prepared? Because if these idiots don't agree with the treaty or whatever we come up with, we have to be able to be ready to prepare to bomb them if he doesn't comply.
Well, you know, why do we have to be the world police, okay? If President Obama is sure that Syrian President Bashar Hafez al-Assad ordered use of chemical weapons, you know, he seems to be sure, but these current events kind of resemble the Bush administration's indictment that Saddam Hussein and Iraq, well, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and we know that there has not been any weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq, but there's a city as big as Minneapolis in downtown Iraq, ran by Americans right now. So, and when you bring in Russia into play, Russia holds the veto power of the UN to decide if that would lead, that we could block any resolution for anybody doing anything in Syria through the United Nations. So, I mean, we have to be very clear, because we're getting stuff fed to us from the mainstream media like Christmas gift. These pictures of these bodies lined up so neatly and nice. And there's a website called the Friends of Syria that says they're pointing out that some of these pictures and some of these mainstream media versions of this event are scripted and staged propaganda. So you have that going on. And so, I mean, at one time, wasn't Assad a friend of the United States?
Well, I certainly was. In fact, the United States was courting him a couple of years ago, as most dictators have been the friends.
Yeah, okay.
The two who are deceased were, at one point, very close friends of the United States, Saddam and Gaddafi.
Yeah.
You know, people tend to forget that. But now, to the caller, I mean, only time will tell, you know, what can be worked out. Right now, the Obama administration is working with the Putin plan. The plan that is now under discussion came from President Putin of Russia, who is a very shrewd, intelligent agent, if you will, trained in intelligence gathering and covert operations. We'll just have to see. But, you know, in some respects, President Putin saved President Obama from a serious embarrassment, because the president had painted himself into a corner, and the president was not going to receive the necessary support within the Congress of the United States. He may have prevailed in the Senate. He was not going to prevail in the House. And then that was going to put him in a position of moving ahead without the approval of the Congress, which then is the dream of every conservative in America, because that then leads to the possibility of articles of impeachment. So hopefully the president can get this worked out.
Mm-hmm. Hello?
To this treaty, and that we can trust them. Again, I don't believe that we can. So I'm with the president. I'd rather stay ready, so we never have to get ready, because this is a gentleman that we may have propped him up and others like him, but we can't trust him. This guy, he's shifting everything on the rebels, like a crafty car salesman. So that's another initiative. There's another way that you can't trust the guy, but I'm with the president so far. I think that if this guy doesn't comply, we have to be ready to act. Simple as that.
Okay. Hello. Mr. Edwards. You're still live on the air on Point. We'll return right after these messages. Welcome back to On Point. And we have returned. Mr. Edwards, would you like to continue your train of thought there?
Well, yes. You know, my observation is that, you know, we've got half a truth here and half a truth over there. Mm-hmm. I want to reemphasize, in case, you know, the NSA was involved in cutting us off, the president was to deliver certain information that were electronic intercepts, in which there was chatter, if you will, and orders being given between field commanders of the Syrian army, particularly the 4th Division, which is the premier division, which actually is under the command of President Assad's brother, in which there were discussions about the use of the of chemical weapons by artillery and et cetera. That never has been produced. Now, I know the modus operandi, and we saw it a decade ago when Colin Powell's career was basically shredded because of misinformation given to him by a group of internal individuals led by Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice. Okay, people want to, you know, try to pretend to forget about that. General Powell, at that time Secretary of State, was given absolute erroneous information, and what's really happened is that the ghost of that kind of deception continues to shadow the United States. It continues to follow the United States' reputation for integrity, veracity, and et cetera. So, you know, what happens when the Secretary of State and the Russian foreign minister meets, that's one particular situation. What happens as it pertains to who will take custodial control of a serious chemical stockpile, those are things that will be worked out. You know, we have to understand that there are actually 5 vetoes on the Security Council. All 5 permanent members of the Security Council have veto authority. People always talk about the Russians and the Chinese. There have been many occasions where the United States has used its veto authority, and I'll give you an example on the issue of chemical warfare in 2000. In fact, it was Syria and Iraq at that time that made a proposal that weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, be taken out of the Middle East. The United States voted against that resolution because they needed to protect the interest of Israel, who is the only nuclear power in that part of the world, okay, other than when American, British, and French, and Russian naval vessels and et cetera make port of calls. And so this is a real delicate situation, but, you know, in many respects, Mr. Allen, actually President Putin, really has maybe saved President Obama from a serious political catastrophe because, as I said before, the president did not have the votes in the House of Representatives to prevail. And, by the way, it was not a declaration of war. It was a declaration of limited engagement. Again, we're playing with semantics and et cetera. So we really don't know. But, you know, the phone lines are open because America has been talking about that. Hopefully our phone lines haven't been tampered with. And if there are calls out there, let's give the number because we haven't given the number yet. Let's give the number so if some folks want to call in. Lines are open. I'm interested to hear the reflections and discussions in light of the proposal by the Russians and the Syrians. Are you still there, Mr. Allen? Well, looks like we've lost Mr. Allen again.
Hey, Mr. Edwards?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually bumped off the air, and you were left there as the host. They had your last, 45 seconds? And I had to redial into the satellite just to get an uplink again. Like, we just heard the show over again. And this is really nerve-wracking because this is not me. I'm sitting here in this studio like we normally sit, looking at the computer screen, and I'm listening to you talk, and then I start to talk. And then you talk, and I talk again, and all of a sudden, I'm logged in, has the anchor, and it totally disappears, and it leaves you on. That has never happened before.
Yeah, that's our good friends at the NSA. Or we're looking at the free Syrian hackers, if you will. And, you know, there's something going on, clearly, if you will, with with folks with some pretty good cyber skills, if you will. But maybe it's the Free Syrian Electronic Army, if you will. But let's get the phone number. Let's see if the phones are working.
Sure.
Let's see if they've cut the phones off.
Well, they're not going to be able to do it to both of us like that again. So I put us both on separate things. So you're on your own line, and I'm on my own line, like we both.
Gotcha.
You know? So,
okay.
So if I fall off, you're not going to fall off unless they cut both of us off. So, yeah, that number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. What do you think the United States should do about Syria? Should we mind our own business? Should we bomb them? Or just, you know, that's an area, Mr. Edwards. I was reading a little bit about the history of Syria. And, you know, it was once the center of the Islamic Empire, and it covered the area that Syria covers has seen invasions and occupations over the ages. And, you know, it gained its independence from France in 1946. And it's a home to, like, a diverse ethnic, religious groups, including the Alawite Shia and the Alawite Shias and the Arab Sunnis, who make up a majority of the Muslim population. But political instability, civil war.
Now, and by the way, we have to be fair to our Christian listening audience, also Christians. In fact, oldest Christian monasteries and abbeys are in Syria, just north of Damascus. In fact, they were attacked just 3 days ago by the Free Syrian Army, who are the insurrectionists and rebels under the control, really, of the West and the United States and et cetera. You're right. I mean, it is extremely diverse, if you will, has a long history and was certainly long independent before, quote-unquote, France, after, I think, it was 40 years of colonial presence, allegedly gave them their quote-unquote, independence. It is a serious mix. One of the things that I'm interested in is the military decisions that will be made by the Israelis at the point that the current negotiations break down and President Obama feels compelled to initiate a surgical, limited military strike against Syrian targets. I'm interested to see how the Israelis will justify moving out of the Golan Heights towards Damascus, setting up a second buffer and attempting to outflank Hezbollah, who is well situated in the south of Lebanon facing Israel's northern border. And this has been one of the more significant concerns militarily of the Israeli high command, is to give themselves additional leverage, if you will, because they are very fearful of the damage that can be inflicted on not only northern Israel, but as far now as central Israel and into the southern part of Israel, where Israel has many of its nuclear facilities, storage facilities, and et cetera, located as you move towards the Niger Desert. These are things, you know, Mr. Allen, you and I have talked about in production and et cetera, that, you know, we're not supposed to talk about in this country. Particularly, we're not supposed to talk about Israel's nuclear capabilities. And so I go back to that resolution in 2000 that was put forward, really, by the Syrians, the Iraqis at that time, talking in terms of making that part of the world free of weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. The United States turned that down. They vetoed it, defeated it, okay? Mm. And it's one of the things that Assad talked about in his interview with an American correspondent a couple days ago, which really was not supposed to be aired, but they really didn't have any choice because they needed to, quote-unquote, enhance the American image of being balanced and fair and talking to the quote-unquote despot of Syria, if you will. So there's a lot at play, and I'm just always fascinated at what the American public is thinking, because the American public, by percentages in some polls of 70 and 80%, are vehemently opposed, Mr. Allen, to any kind of military engagement in Syria at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100%. It's absolutely nuts that we would even consider, you know, playing the world police and going to Syria, because, you know, like It's like picking on the biggest guy in the bar. When you go to a bar, I know anybody that's been involved in a bar fight like myself, you have some big guy in there. It takes a lot of little people to take swipes at him to bring it down. But while he's entertaining all these people taking swipes at him, someone sneaks up behind him and busts him in the head with a bottle. Okay, and that's what I think they're trying to do to us, because we're the military is too spread out. And if they were to even try to go into Syria, we would have to really watch our backs here in the United States. We're looking at something happening major on U.S. soil, period.
But, by the way, on that particular issue of American boots on the ground, which the president keeps saying there wouldn't be, but I watched the hearing of the House Foreign Affairs Committee 8 days ago, when a congressman from Texas specifically asked Secretary Kerry what would be the circumstances that American boots on the ground would become necessary. And that was an interesting question. And the secretary did not say there would never be a situation. He said if it becomes necessary to secure the chemical sites and storage areas and et cetera, it would probably be necessary to put American boots on the ground. Now, that has never been publicized, but the PBS and C-SPAN have tapes of that particular interview, as I do, because I kind of smiled when I heard the secretary say that, because that is consistent with information that, you know, we've been provided with that talks in terms of the different contingency plans that are at play to put American forces inside of Syria, if you will. And that's the reason that they really need the Arab League to get on board. But the Arab League is not that stupid. They will give lip service. They maybe will give a couple dollars of that oil money. Of course, they know they'll get it back because price of gasoline will go up in the United States. It already is. But the Arab League is not going to commit itself militarily, because you said something earlier, Mr. Allen, absolutely on point. And that is the issue of retaliation. And though they said that Assad is just a bag of wind, of hot air, and such, the fact of the matter is that it has been shown before that retaliation could be the order of the day. And in fact, we have not fully dissected the whole issue of Benghazi, okay, mm-hmm. which initially was going to be a campaign issue that was going to lead to the defeat of Barack Obama last November. No one talks about that a lot either. But one needed to listen closely to President Assad when he indicated that there will be consequences. Now, let me say one other thing, Mr. Allen, again, for the phone lines are wide open. I found it amazing, and I've shared that with you in production meetings over the last 15 days, the absence of discussion with respect to the reinforcement of Soviet, or in this case Russian Federation, naval forces in the Mediterranean in absolute close proximity, in fact, right on top of American warships, Russian warships, missile cruisers, and et cetera. No one talked in terms of the possibility of a serious engagement initiated by, quote-unquote, the wrong move. And you and I have talked about that. No mm-hmm. one talked about the presence of a significant Russian armada of warships in the Mediterranean in direct proximity to American warships, and I'm talking about both surface and submerged. No one talks about that.
No, no one says a damn thing about it. No, and there's a lot going on. And I mean, I'm just upset at the fact that the Benghazi thing, that was a big piece, because that was supposed, like you said, supposed to take President Obama out, but we still haven't gotten the full story. And I don't think the Syrian conflict is an American conflict, because I mean, let's look at it like this, Mr. Edwards. We're not making light of the situation, because it is a serious situation, but if it's important for the U.S. to jump in and aid people who are victims of gunshot, murders, and violence, well, then the U.S. should invade Chicago.
I knew you were coming there, and you're absolutely right. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, really, I mean, if you look at it, it's that silly. I mean, we haven't dealt with the issues here. Now, Mr. Edwards, I was talking to this colonel out at Fort Snelling, okay, and he remembers me from my Army days at Fort Lewis, Washington. He's a cool guy. And we were just talking about the amount of money on paper that it would take to do a bombing sortie, to get chips sortie and to get troops and boots on the ground to fly those million-dollar jets. And all that money that was $1 billion or whatever we're spending a month could be put back into American economy to make America strong like it was in the 60s and 70s and mid, up to the middle 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And keep blowing this money on these Iraq, Afghanistan, and all these other places, and no money's being put back into the United States infrastructure. So we have starving people here. We have homeless people here. We have people here that are in combat zones. And I don't understand the rationale of the people that keep, you know, I'm leaning to the right. I'm somewhere between Ronald Reagan and George Bush. But I don't understand why people, especially black people like us, that go to the polls and put these people in office, especially locally. I mean, Barack Obama was historical. We needed a black president. I'm just going to leave it at that, okay? But even locally here in the Twin Cities, I mean, we have some of the same problems we had since, you know, 30 years ago. But we keep voting for the same people.
If not longer. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And so with that said, I mean, we have to look at the full picture because this is could have serious implications on our economy. Okay, we know that when the Gulf War started, that, you know, things kind of got shaky. Gas went up $4 or $5, almost $5. And if this war, even if it is a war, I mean, if they declare war, if they go in and bomb, they're declaring war, period. But what will happen is the gas prices will go up, more money will be sucked out of the economy, more people will get laid off, companies will downsize, you'll have troops, and there's no telling, they could start up the draft, because I was actually talking to this colonel, like I said, and he says, you know, they're really itching to do some drafting, you know, to get some of these 18 to 21-year-olds that's just sitting around laying on the couch in wife beater T-shirts, you know, to do something. Like in Israel, when you graduate from high school, you go in the military.
Mandatory military service.
Yeah, and that eliminates. They have zero youth violence problems in Israel. I just want people to know that. And I mean, you have your few ragtag people here and there, but I mean, I met people at Matt Hammond's church when they had like a tribute to Israel, and you had all these kids on stage, 17 years old. Well, what are you going to do after you get out of school? Well, I'm going to serve in the military for a couple of years, and then it pays for their school. Basically,
that's
if they
right.
want to go, and so, I mean, there's some benefits to that rationale, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that the American economy, if President Obama stays on his course, if he decides that, you know, we want to take over Syria. Syria, I think, is in servitude to the United Arab Emirates. Don't people, if I'm not mistaken, I think I read, Mr. Edwards, you correct me if I'm wrong, because I know you know this, that people from Syria go to the United Arab Emirates to work, or be like household people, butlers.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. They come from Syria, but they also come from as far away as the Philippines. Oops, you know what I mean?
Oh,
Indonesia.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the Arab Emirates, if you will, Bahrain, if you will, Oman, Qatar, Saudi
mm-hmm.
Arabia, if you will. And, you know, you're absolutely correct, and that's why I said earlier in this conversation that the Arab League will, you know, give some lip service, maybe a couple dollars, but they are not going to commit any of their military forces to direct on-the-ground combat, if you will. And that is an issue that has not been properly and honestly discussed and debated in this country. I mean, I've seen the Secretary on 8 or 9 occasions now in the last 10 to 12 days talk in terms of the Arab League, you know, the United Nations, quote unquote. And certainly what all countries are basically saying is that, yeah, you know, but we do not want to, if you will, expose ourselves to retaliatory actions inside of our own countries, you know. And that's one of the reasons that the European Union, with the extension of Great Britain and France, who are, you know, talking in terms of what they're going to do. But you have to understand the contribution of Great Britain and France militarily will be to send a couple destroyers, okay, position maybe 10 or 11 or 12 jet fighters, all right, and maybe a couple of cargo aircraft, if you will, C-5s, that kind of thing. They're just not going to commit. And by the way, you need to know that the military planners have indicated that if the United States even got caught in a situation of boots on the ground to secure whatever it is that they need to secure, it would take a minimal force of 75,000 Americans. That's
mm-hmm.
a minimal force. And that would basically be, and as a former military man, I know you understand that, I understand what I'm getting ready to say, that would basically be the garrison, okay,
mm-hmm.
the garrison. Not talking about out in the countryside, if you will, securing strategic areas and et cetera. In order to do that, now we get back into the whole concept of the disaster of Vietnam. And see, there's too many folks here, young people that don't really understand what happened with respect to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam started out as a police action, okay,
yes.
with American troops being used in 1960 and 61 and 62 as quote-unquote military advisors, okay? By the time it was over, the United States had deployed over 500,000 troops. And by the way, 77,000 young African-Americans lost their lives in the Vietnam conflict. And it came at a time when we were at the height of our own, quote-unquote, consciousness movement here in the United States of America. 77,000 of our best lost their lives in the Vietnam War, okay? And, again, it's the kind of thing we don't talk about here in the United States. We try to stay away from it. So this, all these different scenarios that folks are talking about, you know, you have to look at it within the historical context, because it's not like, sir, as you know, it's not like we haven't been here before. But, again, that phone lines are open. I'm interested to see if there are any callers out there.
Yeah, that phone number, again, is 347-426-3904. And Mr. Eretz, I was just thinking, you know, you said 75,000 troops would be a minimum just to form the garrison, you know, like you
That's
said.
Right.
Now, if Iran gets involved and say, you know, there's some Syrian sympathizers that are out there in some of those countries in the Middle East, you know, you're looking at casualties, you know, in the beginning, the first maybe 30 days of maybe up toward 10,000, you know, if they really start going crazy over there. And if they use chemical weapons, and if they have chemical weapons, or even if Iran just fires some of those, you know, Iraq, I should say, fires those Scud, whatever they have over there now. But then
no,
again,
you mean the Iranians. Yeah,
yeah,
let me go over the scenario of
okay.
what you're talking about. If the conflict starts, and where Assad was coming from and what he was saying, is that it would be the intention of those who were supporters of Syria, including the Russians, and also, rest assured, my friend, that China and North Korea come into play in their part of the world, okay, because they can be very mischievous. They can do a whole lot of things. And you said it earlier in your comments that that no one is paying any attention, that though certainly we have a large standing army and et cetera, but our armed forces are stretched out. But let's say conflict starts. One of the most dangerous forces is Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm.
Situated in Lebanon, basically is the legitimate government of Lebanon now, is the most significant military force there. In fact, the Lebanese army, so-called regular army, has been well integrated into Hezbollah. Hezbollah controls the military compass in Lebanon. Hezbollah will unleash thousands of Katyusha rockets into northern, central, and southern Israel. Okay, you have that situation. Now,
yeah.
The plan that has been discussed is that President Putin has assured both the Iranians and others that one of the things that they need to do to back the United States and others off of Iran and the concern about Iran's nuclear program is to force Israel to show its nuclear hand. And I said earlier on this program, and I say it on numerous occasions in my columns and other radio programs, no one talks about the fact that Israel is a nuclear predator, okay? And they have been the bully in that part of the world for a long time, all right? And whenever they decide to rattle their nuclear saber, the Israelis do that with the full support of Big Brother, the United States, all right? Now, one of the plans that is being said within the intelligence community is that Putin put together a master plan over the last 4 years to draw Israel out. It's one of the reasons that the Russians sent surface and submerged ships into the Mediterranean, because one of the issues at hand, and this is why this is so sensitive and dangerous, is that the Russians really want to provoke the Israelis, all right? Russia has a very large naval base in northern Syria, all right? Nobody talks about that. Now, in the last 10 days, Russian supply ships have gone into their port, just like Guantanamo. You know Guantanamo, don't you, Mr. Allen?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And you know how fierce we Americans are about the right of Guantanamo to be on the sovereign soil of Cuba, because we don't like the Cubans. Okay. But the Russians have been provoking the Israelis with regards to, yes, we're bringing supplies in through our naval facility here in northern Syria. We're then shipping it into Lebanon to Hezbollah. You did some bombing Israel earlier in the year. You attacked some targets that seemed to be using supply routes and et cetera. But what we're going to do is use official Russian military equipment. Now, you attack our equipment, we consider that an act of war. These are the scenarios, Mr. Allen, that are not being talked about.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
And they're serious. There's very, very serious implications if this even goes that far. I mean, how do they back off now? I mean, they've been President Obama, his administration. I had the news on Channel 9, and they had pictures of an earlier news conference. And I mean, I don't know how they back off this, how they back down, because anything could happen now. I mean, with the
Say this again in the strongest possible terms. Actually, President Putin, and I'm not a fan of President Putin, but I do respect the fact that he is a shrewd thinker, diplomatically and militarily. He actually has given President Barack Obama an out by saying, look, let's get back to the negotiation table. We'll take control of serious chemical weapons. We will bring in. Now, think about what the Russians are getting ready to do. We will put Russian boots on the ground inside of Syria. We will secure the facilities, okay? And we will make sure that the Syrians do not use this. And then we will try to negotiate a comprehensive peace between the warring factions, okay? Now, that lets everybody off the hook. Everyone knows how diplomacy works on this planet, particularly in the Middle East, okay? It'll take 3 years to determine what the configuration of the table should be to sit at, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
It'll take 3 years just to do that, all right? And then it'll take another 3 years to determine who will have status at the table. I mean, these folks are thinking all the time, but what that does, it saves the Obama administration from the humiliation that I maintain that he was facing in the Congress of the United States. He did not have the votes to move ahead, and I really could.
Mr. Edwards? Oh, geez, not again. Minneapolis Mayoral Candidate, Doug Mann, how are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good.
Why don't you stand by? Let me see if I can get Mr. Edwards back on here. Go ahead with your, Mr. Edwards? Okay, Mr. Edwards' studio line is down for the moment. Go ahead, Mr. Mann. You have a comment?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to mention that I've heard that there isn't a lot of oil in Syria, but there's an awful lot of it in the neighborhood. From the perspective of the United States and the corporations that are protected by the United States, access to Middle East oil is very important in the Persian Gulf region. You have probably about 90% of the high grade, low weight crude oil in the world, and this stuff is very inexpensive to process, and it's generally cheap to extract from the ground. Also, so it's this is you know, the reason why the United States is so involved militarily in the Persian Gulf region is that it wants to have not only access but control, effective control over these resources.
Mm-hmm.
And we've heard a lot of propaganda from the administration about how exceptional the United States is. You know that, you know, we're just about the moral, good guys.
Yeah.
Right.
But you know, the United States itself has used chemical weapons. You know, we're the only country that's ever used atomic bombs. So, and actually, there was an accord that the United States signed against the use of weapons of mass destruction. I think it was just after the bombing of Hiroshima and just before the bombing of Nagasaki. We used the white phosphorus in Fallujah just in 2005. I mean, the United States has a long history of using chemical weapons, and we only get upset if somebody else uses them.
Yeah, but we can't forget about in 1980s when Iraq was complicit in a chemical attack against Iran in the 1980s, according to there were some declassified CIA documents, as reported by Atlantic Wire, that, you know, we fooled around back then with chemical weapons also. So,
well, let's go a little deeper, because Mr. Mann is absolutely on point, and for years I've talked about it, and I've had fun challenging those so-called conservative thinkers and the rest of them. Actually, there are documents, Mr. Allen, that I think that you're talking about, but there are also pictures of a young congressman in 1980 and 81 meeting with Saddam and his general staff, and his role was to shepherd chemical weapons to the Iraqis in their fight against Iran. The United States was still smarting over what had happened with respect to the ouster of the Shah. That congressman was a young congressman from Illinois by the name of Donald Rumsfeld, the same Donald Rumsfeld who became Secretary of Defense. Those pictures have been shown for a number of years. In fact, there are some websites, gentlemen, that you can go on to, and you will see these pictures. Those documents have not been declassified of what the role of Donald Rumsfeld was as special envoy from the United States to Iraq. It's one of the reasons I maintain that, and I think Mr. Mann would have an appreciation of this, that in the case of the execution of Saddam and the outright murder of Gaddafi, the United States was very complicit in that because it was important to silence both of those men in regards to their relationship with the United States on a number of occasions during their tenure, quote-unquote, as the bad guys. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Mr. Mann, you've done some research on that, and I think you would concur that at one time, and this came up at the beginning of this show, Mr. Allen, both Gaddafi and Saddam were our friends and buddies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. When Saddam was being positioned to bleed Iran, he was our buddy. And when Gaddafi was doing some things as it pertains to some of those in the in Africa, if you will, that quote-unquote had disturbed us, if you will, had annoyed us, if you will, he was quote-unquote a friend and an ally. In fact, people tend to forget that Gaddafi really was sucker punched when he agreed, as part of the conditions of the TWA bombing, or excuse me, Pan Am bombing, when he dismantled, you got to remember, Gaddafi dismantled his nuclear capabilities, and you see what his reward was, a bullet in the head.
Mm-hmm. Yep, mm-hmm. Absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Mann, would you concur?
I would concur. I agree with everything you've said so far.
Okay, yeah. See, it's all a part of history, and it's a part of what is suppressed and censored. See, we don't like to talk as journalists, as members of the Fourth Estate, But censorship is alive and well here in the United States. And actually, the revealing of the NSA's role, particularly by a man that I consider to be an American hero, and that is Edward Snowden. They can say all they want about Edward Snowden, but no one tends to attack the information that he has been providing. Okay? Edward Snowden told what a lot of us have known for many years with respect to what the covert role of this country is. By the way, let me say this also, and we still have you with us, Mr. Mann. I find it interesting how people talk in terms of the humanitarian, and when I came back in, Mr. Mann was talking about this charade that we play about our humanitarian concerns and et cetera. One of the most devastating acts of genocide in modern history after the Second World War was in a place called Rwanda and Burundi and the Eastern Congo, gentlemen. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
And this country did nothing about that. Now, they did concentrate after a while on what was happening in Kosovo, if you will, and the former Republic of Yugoslavia. But I, as an African-American, were absolutely offended by the quote-unquote turning away from the genocide that was taking place in black Africa in the
1990s. Yeah, sounds like a little hypocrisy going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Anything else, Mr. Mann? Let me ask you this question, because you are a strong mayoral candidate, and then we have you there. We can have some fun with it the last 15 minutes. What is your thinking about what is happening with the Viking Stadium, Mr. Mann?
Huh. It's interesting. They're moving forward with it. I think they're still not quite in a position to sell bonds because the judge hasn't issued a ruling on the referendum question. I'm still awaiting a ruling.
And let me say this, Mr. Mann, and no one in the majority media has given you any credit, sir, for being the person that has caused that to happen. As I guess you may or may not know, the Special Legislative Commission, Mr. Allen, that was created by legislative decree has refused to meet and would not meet yesterday in closed session, because they did not want to discuss the fact that they have not sold those $348 million in bonds.
Mm.
And that is an opening for Ziggy Wolf, because at some point in the next 20 days, Ziggy Wolf is going to begin to raise the question about the state and the city of Minneapolis' obligation to provide their fair share. And, Mr. Mann, you're to be commended, because no one is giving credit to what issues Mr. Mann raised in his lawsuit as it pertains to the unconstitutionality, or in this case, the violation of the Minneapolis City Charter in rushing ahead, pushing ahead, and beating ahead the location of the quote-unquote People's Stadium.
Well, one thing that I raised is that the constitutional authority of the legislature to tell the city to violate its own charter is lacking.
Absolutely. Now we get some bad feedback. I don't know what's happening, but
okay, I got it.
See if we can clean it up. Go ahead, Mr. Mann.
That's one of the, I could have possibly, gone to Ramsey County and filed a different type of extraordinary writ against the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
But, and in fact, the judge in this case had suggested that as an alternative, a writ of prohibition.
Is that right? He did do that. Okay.
Yeah, he did do that. And then, I think I've got us made a strong case that the city council violated its own charter, a charter that had not been, or charter provisions that had not been repealed by the legislature. Legislature does have the power to do something like that, but they didn't. And the legislature does not have the power to, you know, tell the city to violate, you know, its own charter.
Just, mm-hmm.
So, you know, if, it's hard to say, it's hard to read the judge, but I think that the, you know, if he's impartial and, you know, follows the law, there's a chance that this could go.
And we're talking about Judge Bush, correct? So that our
Judge
listening
Bush.
Audience across the country knows we're talking about Judge Philip Bush. By the way, Mr. Mann, do you have an indication of when the judge will hand down his decision on this constitutional question?
I checked on the status of the case. I've been checking on it the last few days. It's it was again put on under advisement on this past Monday, which may mean that it's on the front burner and the guy's working on the thing. And I'm hoping to see a decision before the end of the week, possibly.
Would you not think? Let me ask you this kind of rhetorical kind of question. Would you not think that it would be important in the minds of many that he do make that decision before it is revealed that Ziggy Wilf and the Viking ownership will not be returning to the negotiation table? What's your thinking on that?
I don't know that he's necessarily all that concerned about that sort of a timetable. The thing is, you know, he asked me to explain to him, give him the reasons that he needed to order the city to either put the thing on the ballot on the next general election or to hold a special election, you know, say within 90 days. And so it wouldn't be, you know, so if he can go with that, the timing wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't be that crucial
okay.
on this thing. It would piss off, you know, the people who are trying to put together this deal, obviously.
Right. Let me ask you this question, Mr. Mann, because as both a mayoral candidate and the only person in the state of Minnesota on behalf of the people to challenge the constitutionality of what both the legislature did and what the city of Minneapolis, his governing body, the city council, acquiesced to. What is your feeling about the ability of the city of Minneapolis to meet its $150 million obligation under color of law to the stadium?
Oh, I think it's that's a good question because, you know, I think with the taxes that they're imposing, I think they're going to possibly run short, and they'll have to go back to the legislature and ask for permission to increase the local tax rates. Before this, you know, I read an interesting analysis of this situation, the whole funding situation before the city council voted on it, and I guess there was a guy, what is it, Mark Kaplan,
former councilman, 8th Ward, 30 years ago. Go ahead.
And he's also in the bond selling business. And
yes, he is.
He initially came up with projections that showed the city of you know these tax revenues coming up quite a bit short in terms of, you know, delivering the revenues that they needed to pay off these bonds and also meet their ongoing obligations for the, you know, for the operations of the stadium. So then he went back and revised his projections because those projections weren't good enough, and suddenly there was a small surplus. Now we consider the projections on the pull tab revenues or whatever.
But first it was the pull tabs, and then that didn't work, and they were, you know, 89% short, and so then we were going to have electronic bingo. That hasn't even got off the ground. They are 80% short right now as we talk with respect to the anticipated revenue from pull tabs, electronic pull tabs. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, we could conceivably fall pretty short on on the revenues from these special hotel and restaurant sales taxes.
Yes. Okay.
Among other things. And the whole way that was presented to the city council, the research that was done by that that went behind that, it's all pretty questionable. But there's a good chance that the city is going to be on the hook for a lot of money, and they'll either have to get the legislature to allow them to raise local taxes some more, or dip into the general revenues to make up the shortfall. But
now,
the city has.
Go ahead, sir. Mm-hmm.
But the city does have that has a responsibility to pay these state issued bonds.
Absolutely. Now let me ask you a question, because we still have about 6 minutes left. What is your understanding of what is happening with respect to the financing for the so-called People's Plaza? And you've hit on a very sensitive point for our city mothers and fathers, and that is the mayor just announcing a $30 million facelifting along the Nicollet Mall, $150 million or more for the so-called development of the People's Plaza, and et cetera. I'm like you. I'm just trying to wonder, where is this money going to come from, particularly in a state that is not able to raise its portion, $348 million, in contribution to the stadium. I'm just trying to figure out, because now we're approaching easily a $1 billion with interest and et cetera. I'm just trying to figure out where that money is going to be found. Now, the Star Tribune did a editorial in Sunday's edition of the paper, gentlemen, which actually hinted on the fact that there aren't the right kind of people living in the city of Minneapolis, and in order for the city of Minneapolis to grow and increase its population, the right kind of people need to move back into Minneapolis.
Is that a Republican?
Don't you mean the white kind of people?
I didn't want to say it. I wanted one of you gentlemen to say it.
You're absolutely
correct.
That's an old code word.
Yes, it is. And that's this newspaper, our newspaper, who, by the way, has $100 million investment and anticipated profit in the People's Stadium, our beloved Minneapolis Star Tribune, wrote a two-page story and a half a column in their Sunday edition of the paper, saying that we need to have the right kind of people move back into the city of Minneapolis, Mr. Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said, there are just too many uneducated and poor people in the city of Minneapolis, and it no longer has the attractiveness that we should come to expect, if you will. That was in Sunday's edition of our Minneapolis Star Tribune spokesman, quote-unquote, courier and everything else. But I call it the Johannesburg Times.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Mann, let me ask you this sensitive question. If Judge Bush is to rule against you, are you in a position, and are you giving any thought to appealing to the state Supreme Court, or to the Court of Appeals and then the state Supreme Court? What is your – can you discuss your thinking on that at this hour?
Well, I'm going to have to look at the decision and see just how appeal-proof it is. There's a strong, if he does rule against me and it looks like he's got pretty solid ground, I'm not too likely to appeal it. If
you'll be more inclined to stand down. Okay, gotcha.
Right. If it looks like I would have a shot of prevailing in an appeal, if he made a very weak case, or there are some kind of real holes in it. The other thing that I would need to do is to get some serious backing.
Absolutely. You're doing this obviously pro se, and there is no pro bono money out there for you. Do you also understand, though, that if Judge Bush rules in your favor, you clearly know that both the city and the state, you will have powerful, powerful forces arrayed against you, because all of them will appeal his decision to the both the appellate court and then the unholy alliance of the seven-member Minnesota Supreme Court. But I think it's important for people to hear from the man who's been the only individual in this state to test legally the decision by the Minneapolis City Council to circumvent its own charter.
Oh yeah, one thing about this this development of the People's Plaza and so forth. One thing that really gave me a way to, bring in the possibility of a special election was the parking facilities provision of the stadium legislation. Now,
that's right.
Minneapolis is doing its own financing. It's not laundering, doing the money laundering scheme for that. It's taking direct responsibility for incurring debt. And, that's where I was able to make an argument that that the charter provision that would trigger a special election would come into place. Now, the judge, I think, is expecting if he rules in my favor, he will get challenges on a number of grounds, including his own standing to rule in this case.
Right, because there is specific language, and we're down to basically the last minute, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Allen. There are provisions in the legislation to basically indicate that no one other than the state Supreme Court has standing to adjudicate anything like that. Mr. Mann, want to thank you. We're going to ask you to come back with us next Wednesday. We're going to have a better feel because the Vikings should have returned to the negotiation table. Thank you again, Doug, and hopefully we'll be hearing from you next Wednesday. Thank you. Mr. Allen, hand it off to you, sir.
We'd like to thank everybody for listening today. We'll be back next Wednesday, same time, 8:30, hour and a half show. Thanks for listening.
We've been built, and we've been gone. We've been dreamed and talked about. As you and you moan. But that was you, as I take you out.